Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Well Armed Radio, our first official broadcast. We had a test broadcast 2 weeks ago, thanks to those of the listeners who tuned into that and worked through a few technical issues with me. We had a good show. We talked to Attorney John Monroe, a Wisconsin Carry attorney from Atlanta. Hopefully we've got our levels, our volumes good today, and there's no technical issues. I will be monitoring the Well Armed Radio Facebook page, so feel free to comment on the Facebook page if you first let me know you can hear me okay, and we'll work forward from there. So I want to thank you for tuning in. I was going to take the opportunity to first get a little bit of a background on myself. Hopefully a good number of people tuning into the show based upon the channels through which I promoted the show are going to be people who are familiar with my role with Wisconsin Carry and perhaps me on a personal level. But I wanted to take the chance to for those who might be tuning in who I haven't met, haven't had a chance to talk to before or know personally, give a little bit of background on myself, tell you about me, where my involvement in Right to Carry started, and then also go through where I want to go with the show. And there's some interesting angles that I'd like to take with Well Armed Radio. Certainly not going to stick completely to gun topics, though I think the concepts that apply to Right to Carry are concepts that apply to other parts of our life. And that's something that I want to do with this show also. As I planned the show and had the logo developed and thought about taglines and things like that, the concept of being armed with knowledge. Obviously, a gun is a tool that we use that we hope we never have to, but we carry for self-defense. But knowledge is our greatest weapon. I believe that, and I believe with knowledge we can do things far greater than any other. A little bit of background on myself, and I'll apologize in advance as I continue to work through multitasking and get through the technical aspects of running the studio here. Hopefully there'll come a point when I have a producer can handle some of the technical things, but I'm trying to multitask now. So it's a little bit distracting, but I appreciate you bearing with me. I had a crude joke as I started this, thought about introducing this show, and I don't know if it's appropriate, but this is the internet. So I've been told that broadcasting is like sex and no one's good at it the first time. So bear with me. And this will get better. And if I've offended anybody now, we're just getting started. So what is Well Armed Radio? First, a little bit about my background. Born in Michigan, 38 years old. I'm the chairman and president of Wisconsin Carry. That's how I got into the, I shouldn't say that's how I got into the gun rights movement, but that's my current major time contribution to the gun rights movement as chairman of Wisconsin Carry. Born in Michigan, grew up in Walworth County, grew up in Delavan, great place to grow up, always something to do. I love Wisconsin. I love Lake Michigan. I'm a boater. Spent the weekend here boating. Hopefully as the seasons roll on, get a little bit more of a summer-like weekend. I don't know if we've really had one yet this year. It seems like the weather's kind of been a few warm days during the week, but Went to University of Wisconsin Whitewater, graduated in 1998 with honors, had my degree in Bachelor's of Business Administration, studied sales, marketing, and economics. I always tell people I have my economics minor, which I actually don't. I studied a lot of economics, but I was a few credits short of my minor, but that doesn't stop me from telling people I have an economics minor. Moved to Milwaukee in 1998 after I graduated from Whitewater, and that actually around that time is when my interest in right to carry really started to increase. I recall seeing an infomercial. My 21st birthday present to myself was actually a handgun, a Glock 23. I actually bought it at Dam Road Gun Shop in Delavan. Still carry that gun on a regular basis. I actually was just going through some stuff in my basement the other day, and I found my receipt in my original box from that first gun purchase back in, I want to say 95 or 96 when I turned 20. I had to be 95 when I turned 21. So I purchased a gun. Obviously, at that point in time, here in Wisconsin, open carry was technically legal, though few people knew about it. But it wasn't until 98 when I moved up here to Wisconsin, or excuse me, moved up here to Milwaukee, that I heard an infomercial that the NRA did. And they talked about what happened in California with gun confiscation, that previously they had some legislation passed that people with certain types of weapons had to register those weapons. And then a few years later, they changed the legislation and made those types of weapons illegal. And then people who previously registered weapons under the assumption that they were doing the law-abiding thing and they were still allowed to own these weapons. It was just a matter of being able to register them and keep them. And then as they changed the law, they had a list of people who owned weapons that were now banned, and they went and confiscated those weapons. So that really made a lot of what I used to think was just fear-mongering. I used to hear the NRA talk about people losing their guns and confiscation. And I always thought, you know, as I was younger, that was just a marketing tactic from the NRA. But then when you realize that this is real and this really happened, it really clicked for me, and I thought that the gun rights issue was something I wanted to get involved in. So I joined the NRA in 98, and around that same time started to read and research more and realized that other states, people could actually carry to defend themselves. And I thought that was a magnificent concept. Obviously, as a law-abiding citizen, there's an amount of personal security in carrying, as we know, we in the carry movement recognize. So at that point in Wisconsin, you know, we didn't have that right. That right was being denied to us, though people in other states did have the right to carry concealed. 2002, 2003 was the first time that legislation made it out of, I believe, committee at the State House for concealed carry here in Wisconsin at the time. It was called the Personal Protection Act. And Dick Baker was a gentleman who had an association called the Wisconsin Concealed Carry Wisconsin Concealed Carry Association. So I hooked up with Dick and worked a couple of trade shows with him, Waukesha County gun shows, back in, I think, 2002, 2003. And when we really didn't expect a whole lot from the legislation, it was just such a shock that it actually made it out of committee. And then I didn't mark the timeline down here from my notes today to talk about, but a lot of us probably recall the time when it made it out of committee, made it to, I think it passed one house. I don't remember if it was the first year, but then there was a kind of a parliamentary trick to avoid it getting a vote in the year that would have passed. And I believe Governor McCallum was governor at the time who would have signed it into law back in 2000. Again, I think this was probably 2003 when the bill was, I believe it was the Senate at that point, and they were promised a vote on the bill, and then they kept putting taking up a vote on that bill off, and then the Senate, which was controlled by a Democrat majority at the time, called a rule of order, which had something to do with dress code. And as the Republicans in the chamber were looking at their rule book, the Democrats walked out, and that ended the session. And that ended that first round of concealed carry debate here in Wisconsin. So it was pretty frustrating at that point. It was kind of my first involvement in legislation, and really to be so disappointed, not just that the legislation failed, but more so the process by which it failed. That's something that always stuck with me. The parliamentary trick that was used to take away even an honest vote on right to carry, you know, it's something that would be different if they voted and it failed. But to really at that first point feel like you'd come so far and tried so hard and then have it taken away was something that, that stuck with me, and I know it stuck with a lot of people in the Right to Carry movement. Moving forward from there, obviously, we recall Governor Doyle vetoed it a couple times. But at that point, I was involved in paying attention and reading everything I could and wearing my NRA T-shirts every day, everywhere I went out. And then it wasn't until 2008, 2009, when the open carry concept came about. And during the Doyle administration, a lot of people were pretty confident that we wouldn't have concealed carry and that it was going to take getting the governor's office in order to have the legislation pass. And a lot of us got impatient with that. And in 2008, 2009, I heard a discussion that open carry was getting traction here in Wisconsin. Back in the 90s, right after I'd actually purchased my first gun, I recall that Wisconsin passed a preemption statute, which basically said that no individual subdivision of the state could have more restrictive gun laws than the state did. And when they passed that, some municipalities who might have banned carry within their municipality, those laws were no longer enforceable. And I recall seeing it on the news at the time. This is, again, in the mid to late 90s. And they said, well, yeah, technically, you know, you can open carry. Concealed carry was illegal by statute, so technically you could open carry, but you'd probably get a disorderly conduct citation if you did. And at the time, there wasn't really internet message groups and ways to communicate like there is now and organize. So I recall, but I recall seeing that on news, and I thought that was an interesting concept. And then it came back up in 2008. And of course, at that point, we have blogs and websites dedicated to just about every subject matter you can think of. And one of them was opencarry.org. That's a website. Mike Stolenwerk and John Pierce are two gentlemen. I know Mike's out of the D.C. area. I think John may have been studying at Georgetown with Mike. Mike and John studied law there together. I think I might be getting this wrong. So if you're listening, Mike and John, I apologize. But they had a website, opencarry.org, where here in Wisconsin, being that open carry was the only legal way to carry, a lot of people were speculating that, well, you can just do this. We're just going to carry and see what happens. And a couple people did that, were arrested, but not charged, and that emboldened more people to do it. Then at some point there in 2009, perhaps it was late 2008, there was a gentleman in West Dallas who was planting a tree in his yard. He was arrested for open carrying, charged, tried at the municipal level, and he beat those charges. And then shortly after that, the Attorney General came out with a memo that said that open carry was legal. And that really opened the floodgates here. That's the first time I carried open carried out in public. The Attorney John Monroe, who was actually representing a gentleman who had been unlawfully arrested for open carry, actually referred a news station to myself because he had just left town after filing a lawsuit. So I talked with Channel 12. I remember Brendan Conway had interviewed me that night and said, well, you're going to open carry? And I said, yeah. So they came to my house and I open carried that night out in my neighborhood. And he's like, well, you're going to, you know, when you go out in public, are you going to open carry? And I said, yeah, I am. So that Friday, we had planned that he was going to follow me as I went grocery shopping. So while I was open carrying, so I went to that week, I was telling some friends, yeah, I'm going to start open carrying this weekend when I go grocery shopping, and Channel 12 is going to be there. And they were kind of my security blanket, knowing that a lot of people were still going to see, not necessarily be arrested, but definitely have police contact. I thought, well, what a better way to document that you weren't doing anything wrong than to have the news camera following you with video. So they did that. And, of course, the day of Channel 12 and how the news, now with my work with Wisconsin Carry, I've seen how the news cycle works, and you can really get displaced quickly if a story comes up. But they ended up having to do something else that day. So here I had told all my friends I was going to start open carrying this weekend, and the news channel had canceled on me. So I just called Channel 4. I thought maybe I'd see if I had another station interested, and talked to the news editor. And he said, yeah, do you have a news story? And I said, yeah, I was going to go grocery shopping today and carry while I do so. And he said, yeah, carry what? And he was really disinterested. I said, carry a gun. He's like, you're going to carry a gun in the grocery store when you grocery shop out in the open. I said, yep. And he's like, all right, hang on. So they sent a news reporter out and a hidden camera producer. Heather Shannon was the reporter that came out, did a story. And Mike from opencarry.org saw the art or the story run. And after that, I open carried through a pick and save with a hidden camera following me. Spoke to the reporter and talked about the intent of why I was doing this, why I was doing it on TV to raise awareness. And that prompted me to have a conversation and a dialogue with Mike. And he had suggested that we start a group here in Wisconsin. And I told him at that time, you know, there's other groups here. There's WeForce, there's the Wisconsin Patriots, there's Wisconsin Concealed Carry Association. You know, I didn't see a need to split the effort one more way. I thought that would just water down the effort here in Wisconsin. But late fall of 2009, we had the gun-free school zone issue to deal with in terms of open carry. That was really prohibitive in terms of where you could carry. So we wanted to start file a lawsuit. But in order to do that, we needed an organization, and no other organization was really willing to take that on. And that's really why Wisconsin Carry was formed. So that's how this all started with Wisconsin Carry. So that's kind of the story of my background with Right to Carry here in Wisconsin. Obviously now Wisconsin Carry has grown to one of the largest gun rights groups, one of the largest non-affiliated gun rights groups in the state. I'm certain the NRA has more members here in state, but we're the largest independent group. But so that's my background. Well-Armed Radio. My purpose with Well-Armed Radio is twofold. I saw there's other radio programs dedicated to Right to Carry into the gun topic. And in my view, I felt like those programs were very well targeted towards, and I do not mean this to sound pejorative, but towards gun nerds, people who are really interested in guns and the ballistics and types and assortment of guns and collections and that kind of thing. And then maybe towards the mainstream gun owner too. And this program, I don't know. I'm not a big gun collector. I have, you know, a dozen or so guns, or I should say I had a dozen or so guns before they were all tragically lost in boating accidents. But my interest is not in the technical side of guns. So you won't hear a lot of talk in this program about gun reviews and that kind of thing. But more the mainstream right to carry topic. I mean, the freedom angle was always what more appealed to me. And so my target for the gun topic is kind of the middle of the road conversation, more about the practical side of gun ownership and the use of guns, not the nerdy ballistic side. And then to actually step away and take a larger look, the larger context of right to carry and what that means for self-reliance. And that's really when we talk about guns and freedom. Our country does indeed have a gun culture. I mean, the gun is to freedom what the internal combustion engine was to transportation. And I mean, if you think about that, we won our freedom with guns a couple hundred plus years ago, and then we fed our families with guns. And then to this day, we continue to protect ourselves and our families with guns. Guns make people equal. Guns allow you to protect yourself and your life. I mean, think about that. Guns make people equal. If without guns, then it's either people with a lot of money or a lot of influence or a lot of big, strong guys that have power. But guns in the hands of a law-abiding citizen, I mean, even take a one-on-one interaction between a thug criminal and a law-abiding citizen. You know, I walked on an airplane a few years back when they were, well, they still are, but they're taking your pocket knives and everything, and that you can't carry anything. And that's great with me because I'm a big guy. I'm a bodybuilder. And when I walk in that plane, I know that I'm the strongest person on that plane. So I could pretty much do whatever I wanted because everybody's unarmed. But a gun is a great equalizer. A gun in the hands of a 75-year-old woman puts her at equal with me in terms of, you know, power and strength, ability to defend yourself. And I love that. That equalizing factor of a gun is something that I think is phenomenal, and it's important. So guns allow you to protect yourself and your life. Self-reliance is my angle with this program. And when we take a step back from just guns, there's other areas of your life where self-reliance can be leveraged. We know that the cliche is that when seconds count, police are minutes away, and that's certainly true. But we can even look at more recently here, the terror attacks in Boston. Billions and billions of dollars were spent on anti-terrorism efforts. And we now know more clearly, and I'm actually kind of jumping a little bit into my topic that I'll be discussing with Sheriff David Clark in a few minutes. We'll probably have him on in 2 or 3 minutes here. But I wanted to finish up the introduction. But all that money spent on counterterrorism efforts, billions and billions of dollars. And even in some respects where it sort of worked, where this those two or one of the brothers hit the radar, pinged the radar, so to speak, of the intelligence community, it still didn't prevent that. And you think about that, billions of dollars, Department of Homeland Security, new departments of our government, new cabinet positions, and none of that mattered. Now, obviously, a bombing is something much more difficult to protect yourself against, but it just really proves the point that despite government's best efforts, they're not able to protect you. That's really your job, protect yourself and your family. You're really the only person that you know will be there when the time comes and you have to defend yourself. So with that said, I promised Sheriff Clark, Sheriff Clark's a good friend of mine, I promised him that we would have him on around 7:50. So I'm going to get him on the line here. Before I do, I want to play, for those of you, a lot of you are probably familiar with Sheriff Clark and his recent public service announcements. And by public service announcements, I have to say I really believe that in terms of a public service, these are some of the best public service announcements I've ever heard. And I think if you haven't heard them before, when I play them in a minute here, you'll agree. So I'm going to get Sheriff Clark on the line here. And while I do, I'll play this public service announcement.
I'm Sheriff David Clark, and I want to talk to you about something personal, your safety. It's no longer a spectator sport. I need you in the game. But are you ready? With officers laid off and furloughed, simply calling 911 and waiting is no longer your best option. You can beg for mercy from a violent criminal, hide under the bed, or you can fight back. But are you prepared? Consider taking a certified safety course and handling a firearm so you can defend yourself until we get there. You have a duty to protect yourself and your family. We're partners now. Can I count on you?
This safety message brought to you by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
Then hopefully we'll have, I'm working here, hopefully working through my, Sheriff Clark, do we have you on the line? And this is now going to be the wonders of live television. Let me give him a call again here. I'm going to play Sheriff Clark's second public service announcement. We'll get that one going here.
This is Sheriff David Clark. Violent crime went up nearly 10% in Milwaukee. Are you the next victim? You don't have to be, but that's your call. Armed criminals are being put back on the street by a soft-on-crime court system even before the ink dries on police reports. Are you prepared to handle a life or death threat? Wisconsin's Personal Protection Act now gives you the same advantage that I have. Now it's the crook who has to wonder what you might do. Can be a great equalizer, but you always have to think survival. Remember, it's you and me now.
This public safety message brought to you by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office.
And with that, hopefully I've got my technical issues here worked out. Sheriff Clark, do we have you on the line?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Sorry about the false start there. That was probably on my end. Well, so first, Sheriff Clark, I wanted to certainly thank you for coming on the program. And we just played the public service announcements that you've put together, which, as I mentioned previous to dialing you through here, that I think they're truly public service announcements in every sense of the word. And it's definitely hit the national news. A few other things that have been in the news recently were the I think every time you cough and don't cover your mouth, it seems to hit the paper. But recently, I think the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association gave you the Sheriff of the Year Award, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't see that in the paper, but I wanted to say congratulations, and I guess I'm not surprised that the Journal Sentinel couldn't find some space for that.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm humbled by that honor of my, you know, anytime you're honored by your peers and colleagues, it's a big deal. So when they informed me several weeks ago of that designation, you know, of course I was, elated, but at the same time, they recognized me for courage, and I'm not patting myself on the back, but the thing is, like I said, when you're recognized by your peers, it's a big deal. But I want to thank you, Nick, and I want to thank your group and others for being the patriots that you are, because this issue of the Second Amendment and personal defense and those types of things are under siege right now. As you know, this started back when Wisconsin enacted the Personal Protection Act and then the Castle Doctrine. And what I tried to do with that ad after a series of crime incidents that had gone on in the city of Milwaukee, nobody was offering anything. I thought, why don't I leverage those two laws? There are law-abiding citizens out here who, they're not trying to take the law into their own hands, and they're not trying to police, but they see personal defense, their personal defense and personal safety as an individual responsibility. And so I wanted to leverage them and let them know that we're partners in this thing. The ad was kind of self-explanatory, but that was the intent, was to leverage those folks out there that want to do what they can when in those situations that arise, whether it be in their home, whether it be on the street, when the police may be minutes away and seconds matter. So if it weren't for patriots like yourself, like the NRA and other grassroots organizations of people, to be vigilant of the government's ever-encroaching reach into personal freedoms and personal liberties, they're going to subtly wear them away.
Well, and thank you for that. And I have to say, you know, I talk with a lot of people here around Milwaukee County, and I haven't felt such a strong reaction in such a positive way to something like a public service announcement. I was actually picking up the kids from school a couple of weeks ago, and there was a person there who I know, have known for a few years, and not involved in gun rights at all. But I mentioned the radio show, mentioned you'd be coming on, and this mother said, "Oh, I love Sheriff Clark," and I hear that everywhere, and I think it's unfortunate sometimes when you look at things in the Journal Sentinel and how a news media can try so hard to find an opposing view and make it appear as an equal proportion of the people. But I got to tell you, everybody I talk to around Milwaukee County and really around the state just loves your public service announcements and loves your attitude towards rights. So certainly thank you for that. I wanted to, and this kind of goes to context here, when I hear some of the criticisms that are constantly put your way by people who I think seem to believe more in big government than in people. But you know, tell us about your background in law enforcement. When people question what you have to say about police response in Milwaukee, I mean, tell us about your background, because I think that's important that people understand where you've come from.
Sure. I started with the City of Milwaukee Police Department in 1978, so I'm coming up on 35 complete years in serving this community, and it's been an honor and a privilege, really, to have served people in this capacity, and then now that I'm the Chief Executive Law Enforcement Officer as a Milwaukee County Sheriff, that the people once again have shown trust and faith in me, that I'm going to do everything I can with the oath that I took to uphold the Constitution and the laws, so on and so forth. So I spent 24 years with the City of Milwaukee Police Department, and I rose to a command level of captain, worked in a number of different units, divisions. I started out working uniform patrol, so I've been on the streets. I was promoted to detective, lieutenant of detectives, and then captain of police. And you know, I worked homicide. I worked robbery division. Was the commanding officer of the intelligence division before I was appointed sheriff by former Governor Scott McCallum. So I came with a wide range of experience in urban policing. And that's the thing that gets under a lot of my critic's skin is, I'm speaking from experience. I'm speaking from knowledge. I was there. I worked the streets of this city. I continue to work the streets of this city. And when you have that kind of knowledge and experience, it's kind of hard to marginalize people, and it's kind of hard to for them to put me down, even though they'll try to, but they know that that's an uphill climb.
And you've been elected with some pretty substantial margins. And I haven't looked at all countywide races, but I got to believe that your margin of victory, so to speak, and I hate to use the term victory, but you were elected with just a massive majority here in Milwaukee County. It's above 70%, I believe.
In a general election, yes. It's always a tough fight in the primary for me, because my views are politically unacceptable to a good number of people. But, you know, I'm about one thing. I'm about serving the people of this community. I'm about protecting the people of this community, and that includes protecting their individual freedom. So that's why it's always a real battle in a primary. But, you know, Nick, you know me. I'm not afraid of a fight. I'm not afraid of opponents in an election. I think the people should decide. I mean, I feel that strongly about our republic, about representative democracy, that it's the people. The people are sovereign in a representative democracy, not politicians, not office holders. And so I want the people to have a stark choice when it's time for me to run for election, that, yeah, okay, here's Clark, and, you know, here's his record, here's what he stands for. We know that. you know, we may not like everything that he believes in, but, you know, we're going to base this on the job we think that he's doing. And then when it gets to the general election, of course, it's always a landslide. I think I got 75% in my last general election.
And I can't think of anybody who in a countywide race has had that kind of margin in a general election. Next thing I wanted to talk about is, and this is how when you and I first met, it was based on a discussion of you know, really a soft-on-crime court system in Milwaukee, and you've had experience with that, and that's something that as gun owners, I think some people might not be as aware, well, certainly are not as aware of that as you are, but you have a unique perspective when you see some of these laws that are being proposed, and then you turn around and see how laws are not being enforced. Speak to that for a moment, because I think that's something that we all, you know, civilians recognize that on a certain level, but I think you have even a more intimate awareness of how criminals are getting a pass so often, but now they're turning around and asking us to give up some of our rights.
Sure. There's a revolving door mentality and philosophy in Milwaukee County as it relates to prosecution and sentencing, so that would be the judiciary. It makes every cop scream when they go out and do the work within the law that we entrust them and that we demand that they do to enforce our laws, to take crooks, get them off the street, hold them accountable for violating those laws, put them into the criminal justice system, only to have them spit them out. And I've used this phrase, I think, in one of the ads, even before the ink dries on police reports. And that's not an exaggeration. So, you know, you think of all the money that we spend on policing in this city and in this county, and it's undone with the stroke of a pen, with low bail, with watered-down prosecutions, and with lenient sentences. And so we take these individuals and we put them, and they're all career criminals. These aren't second chance people. These are, and that's why I use career criminals. That's what they do. And, you know, they commit crimes. That's what they do for a career. So we put them back into the streets to victimize once again, to victimize your friends, your family, burglarize my home, and basically, you know, intimidate and threaten good people that live in, you know, all throughout the city, and but mainly in the central city. You know, predominantly the folks that live in the central city, predominantly, I mean overwhelmingly, are good law-abiding people. Now, of course, they may be dealing with things like poverty and the lack of some other support structures in their lives, but they're decent people. At least they obey the law. And when they have to live on a daily basis, they can't let their kids play out, even in front of their houses on a nice summer night. They leave their homes. They're afraid of being burglarized. The corners in some of these areas are controlled by drug dealers and gangs. They are pleading for the police to get those individuals out of their lives so they can, even if they're poor and even if they're uneducated and some of these other things, at least they want to live in peace. And that's what I want for those folks. So when the police go out and do that, the officers on the street, and then enter them into the criminal justice system, to have them spit them back out in a short period of time with no accountability and no consequences for their actions, it sends a message to the criminal element that, you know what, we can keep doing this because nothing's going to happen to us.
And I think, and that's the thing that I know that law-abiding citizens recognize on a certain level, but just to, with, you know, from the conversations you and I have had, it makes it that much more infuriating when the solution that's proposed turns out to be restrictions on law-abiding citizens, what guns they can own and what they have to do to buy them. So thanks for your perspective on that. And next thing, in your public service announcements, obviously all of this feeds into motivation for putting those together. What was your moment when you said the public service announcement came to your mind? I mean, was there one factor that you said this is it, I'm going to do it?
Sure. There was a defining moment. There was a burglary spree that was going on in the Sherman Park neighborhood. Sherman Park is a very historic neighborhood in the city of Milwaukee. Great homes, middle class, solid people, and it was under siege by crime and violence, street robberies and burglaries. And a news story came out and it said Milwaukee Police Department is warning people in the Sherman Park area Be on the lookout for, you know, street robberies and burglaries, and they didn't offer anything for the folks to do. In other words, you know, how do you protect yourself? But I said, well, this is crazy. I said, I've had it with this. I've had it with law-abiding citizens being asked to exist in these areas with one hand tied behind their back while the criminal element ravages their lives. So I thought, it's time to put the criminals on defense, to put the criminals on their heels, and to empower law-abiding citizens to take control of their safety, their homes, and their lives. And I said, but they're going to need some sort of message that lets them know, hey, I'm here, and I'm here with you, and we can partner, we can beat back this criminal element. So the intent really was to message, which is why it was a public safety announcement. The message to law-abiding people, here's some things to think about. Here's what you can do. Here's the situation. Because, Nick, I'm not going to fool people. You mentioned response times. Okay, they're horrible in the city of Milwaukee. And it's not the fault of the street cop. They're under siege with calls for service. They don't have the resources. Alderman Bob Donovan has talked about it. So I wanted to give them, the law-abiding people, you know, in this county, some things to think about. So I said, hey, here's some options. I don't like to tell people what to do, especially law-abiding. I just like to give them advice. Here's some things to think about. I said, you can run and hide if you want. You can do this. You can do that. I said, or you can fight back. So I gave them options. And then I said, if you're going to fight back, here's some things to think about. Consider taking a safety course in the handling and ownership of a firearm, you know, A, B, and C. And then in the end, I said, hey, we're partners now. I want to count on you. You can count on me. I got to trust that you have my back. That was how that whole thing came together. And, Nick, nowhere in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that thing would have gone viral the way it did. And the reason I was shocked is because they said, hey, personal defense has always been an individual responsibility. It's always been the right of people to exercise. But what has happened over time is government has taken that away and said, you know, no, just call us. Just call the police. Just call government. You can count on us. We'll take care of it for you. Well, there's some situations, Nick, as you know, where that works. But there are situations where that does not work. There's one thing that statists or big government people do not believe in. It's self-determination, self-reliance. So I've sent a message to the law-abiding people of this community that, hey, you play a role in this thing. There are some things that you can do in these situations where you're under siege, and here's what you need to think about.
You know, and we, Wisconsin Carry offers free concealed carry classes, and it was interesting because after that public service announcements, and I go to a few of these classes while the instructors, you know, when they have breaks, and I talk to some people, and there's people that were in one of the classes in Franklin that we held at a bowling alley there, and one of the persons, you know, I often am interested in people's motivation for taking the class because we really target people who are not yet in the carry movement. And there was several people who said that they heard your public service announcement. That was their motivation. So it worked, and thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate it. But, you know, there's something that's more important to me, and that's that the citizens realize. Because I've had people come up to me and say the same thing, Nick. They've said, hey, you know, I heard your ad, and guess what? I went and signed up for a course. I don't own a gun yet, don't know if I will. However, they're laying the groundwork. And that's what's important. Nick, I trust law-abiding people. Governments don't. But I trust law-abiding people, responsible law-abiding people, to take control of their lives, to be engaged in this thing called personal defense, because the cops are not, and I say that affectionately, I consider myself a career cop, we're not omnipresent. We weren't meant to be, not in a constitutional republic. We're not a police state. So if we can't be there, you know, I said, here's some things that you can do. But I believe, and I always have believed, that a law-abiding citizen is the front line of personal defense and personal safety in this county. It is not law enforcement. We're the reinforcements. We're the backup.
Boston. I want to talk about Boston. I love it when this happens, and I know that you're a humble guy, and you probably don't enjoy it as much as I do, but when people are proven right, you were on, I think it was Vicki McKenna's show after the, a week or so after the bombings. I think it was before the terrorists were captured or killed. And you talked about a massive intelligence failure. And then very quickly, there was some in Milwaukee media who were super critical of that. And now we know what a massive intelligence failure this was. Tell me about that, the context of what you saw and your assessment that there was an intelligence failure here and what we know now, that it was indeed an intelligence failure.
Sure. To me, because of my knowledge and experience in the area of domestic intelligence, to me it was a no-brainer. I didn't feel like I was looking into a crystal ball and making some great proclamation. Nick, these things don't happen. Terrorist attacks, terrorist events do not happen in a vacuum. A guy doesn't wake up one morning never having planned and never having thought about it and said, hey, I think I'll put a bomb together and go blow something up. The 9/11 hijackers, it was the same thing. That planning went on for 6 years. The Fort Hood massacre, that Nadal Hassan is his name, planned that thing for a long time. And there are red flags. There's information out there that comes into law enforcement, and we don't connect the dots, as they like to say. And that's usually what happens in every one of these events, in every one of these incidents. And so I knew that's what it was going to be. It was just a matter of where the ball was dropped and how the ball was dropped. And, of course, several weeks later, the public found out that, yeah, we missed that one.
And despite the criticism that I saw immediately in media, I haven't seen any recognition in local media here that you called that one. I'm assuming you didn't get any phone calls of apology from the local media.
Of course not, and that was all political. Again, it's when they know that you have knowledge and experience, and they can't trump that. They try to marginalize you. That's the strategy they use. I'm used to that. I kind of know what's going to happen, but I don't expect any apology from them. But I don't open my mouth unless I know what I'm talking about.
Back to Boston, and here's one, and you and I haven't talked about this before, and we may even have a different perspective, and I think the first side of it is, you know, then we were on that, I think it was a Friday morning, and they put out they're on TV in the Boston area, putting Boston on lockdown, and they suggested a lot of things that people do or don't do, don't go out, and I didn't hear one suggestion that people might think about arming themselves and protecting themselves. I thought that was a very stark contrast to how effective the message of your public service announcement was, and I couldn't help but think about that when they talked about that. And at the end of the day, with hundreds of people in those neighborhoods, the first thing I would have done was grab a gun to protect myself. And I don't even know if Bostonites are as interested in self-defense. I have this pejorative perception of the East Coast of this country, but I thought that was interesting. One thing I wanted to ask you about and get your perspective on, and I don't even know if we might disagree on this or not, but we can't know for sure what happened with some of these things that we see on YouTube videos, because we don't necessarily hear the audio, but you see people getting taken out of their houses, and then a rush of what I presume was probably federal agents going through. What's your thought on that? I mean, I saw that, and I thought Fourth Amendment violation here, going through house to house and sweeping everybody's house. I mean, if you come to my door and I say, we're good, and of course they come to my door, I'm going to be armed. And now I'm worried that if the police come to my door, if there's a terrorist attack or some kind of event here in Wisconsin, of course, unfortunately, I'm in Waukesha County, not Milwaukee. And if the sheriff came in Milwaukee County, I'd feel really good about that. But what's your perspective on that in the Fourth Amendment in terms of some of those house-to-house searches?
Well, I found it very problematic. And obviously, that was a unique situation, unique circumstances, very dynamic at the time. But that doesn't justify trampling over our United States Constitution. So I'm not going to sit here, like you said, we don't know what was going on in real time in that situation. I know I don't know. And it's easy for me today to say they should have done, you know, A, B, and C, and X, Y, and Z. But I'll tell you what we saw on that day resembles the tyranny of government. So, and again, you know, that will be misconstrued by, you know, a number of people because, of course, you know, they want to, when I say they, the anti-gun folks, anytime I talk, will try to say, oh, he said this and this, this and this. But the thing is, and that's why I preface it by saying it's easy to second guess today, but I found it very problematic. And I think that there should be some kind of discussion I don't know if at the state level in Massachusetts or even at the federal level, as to what went on there and why. And if they did it once, they can do it again.
Well, I think, and that's the other concern, is that I think there's the risk of normalcy when they see something happen and people see it, and then it becomes, they become normalized to it. So,
exactly, and that, to me, that's what I find problematic. If they did it once and nobody said, hey, let's talk about this now that it's over, and should this happen again, here's what we expect, blah, 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 then you're right, it's easier for government to do.
Well, Sheriff, I want to say thank you for your time. I know you got a busy schedule, and I know you've got some things coming up and carving the time out tonight to talk to me. I really appreciate it. And again, I mean, I can't express to you, I wish I could record every time someone mentions to me how positive their perception of you and the job you're doing is. So thank you again.
Nick, it's my pleasure. It's an uphill fight, so I'm encouraged when I hear that the kind of support, and I want to encourage you to keep up the fight as well.
Thank you so much, Sheriff.
You're very welcome.
All right, be well armed.
Thanks.
Bye. Sheriff David Clark, great guy. Let's take some calls. We had a couple calls come over while Sheriff was on the line. If you'd like to call in, I'd like to hear your perspective. I know we've got listeners from around the state, probably a few from around the country, tuned into the show tonight. 646-716-8739 is the phone number. 646-716-8739. Interested to hear your perspective. If you haven't heard Sheriff Clark talk before, just an amazing perspective on your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Obviously, through his public service announcements, you heard that. But when you talk to him, when you hear him, especially his willingness to, and he's a law enforcement guy, and he's not going to throw law enforcement under the bus, but he's acutely aware of the things that we saw, for example, in Boston, that those should be worrisome to people. So 646-716-8739, if you'd like to call in. We have some other topics as well to go through this week. One of the things that I had on my list is drinking and carrying. You know, summer's upon us, and it's an issue that I've seen a lot of contentious debate about on various Facebook groups, Wisconsin Carries Facebook group. So we're going to talk about that moving forward a little later in the show, what's legal, what's advisable. Senator Ron Johnson, just a brief segment I want to do discussing then and now, Senator Johnson when he was a candidate, and how the people, gun rights, perceived him, and then Senator Johnson after the most recent activity in Washington. So we've got a caller I'm going to take here, and we'll see. We don't have a call screener, so we'll take this call live and go from there. And let's get the right button on the... Good evening. You're on Well Armed Radio. Who's this?
Good evening, Nick. Gary Malowski calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Gary, how are you doing? Are you? I'm good. I'm well.
I am a member of Wisconsin Carry, Concealed Carry, and I just want to tell you, I listen to Mr. Clark, and I support him in every way and what he stands for. And as far as your next topic about concealed carrying in a bar, I've been doing it since it's been available. There was one occasion that I was in northern Wisconsin with another member and friend, and he chose that night to conceal carry as well as I did. But later on, I went out, secured my sidearm, and came back into the bar and had a beer with my dinner, and knew at the moment of that decision that my weapon would stay in the trunk of my car for the remainder of the evening. If you're going to do one, you cannot do the other.
Interesting perspective. Well, I appreciate the call. I've got another one here. I want to stick to the Sheriff Clark topic for just a little bit, see if we have a few other comments on that. But, Gary, thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned. I'm looking forward to getting into that topic in about 5-10 minutes here. And thanks for your perspective. Thanks for listening.
And thank you for getting something on the air finally.
All right, Gary. Be well armed.
Have a nice evening.
You too. Good evening. You're on Well Armed Radio. Who's this?
Bob.
Bob, I see you're 608. So are you Madison area, somewhere mid-state?
I am in the Madison area, and I did hear all the part of the show, the first part. I agree with a whole lot of it, especially what your comments were on Boston. Nobody, government-wise, should ever be able to do what they did in Boston, even though they did it under the pretense of whatever you want to call it, saving the community. That is against the Constitution. You're going to talk later on about drinking and driving and carrying. And, of course, I just agree with the previous gentleman. And the last thing I would say would be that I do believe that even though it's been illegal since I've been a kid and I'm 72 years old or thereabouts, I do believe that people that open carry in a public place, even though it's legal, are cowboys. And I don't think that sets the best precedent for what your cause is. End of my comments. Carry on, and it's a good show you got going.
Well, Bob, thanks for calling in, and this is precisely the kind of topic that I was hoping to get into, because I'm aware that there's, you know, back with open carry when that was the only way we could carry, I know there was a lot of people that open carried simply for that fact that it was the only way that you could carry, and they would have really preferred to conceal carry. And then there was other people, and I'm kind of in between. I tend to open carry now more. I tend to open carry now more than I conceal carry. I don't carry more because I carry the same as I did when open carry was the only legal way. But it's an interesting, we see and we felt like often open carry was treated like the stepchild of carry rights. So it's interesting that even within, you know, I presume that you carry yourself, you conceal carry, obviously.
Obviously, I'm Wisconsin and Utah, and so does my wife.
Yeah, excellent. So it's just interesting to see that even within the gun rights community, there's still, you know, we're not monolithic in that that support or lack of support for open carry. But Bob, thanks for the call, and thanks for tuning in. I was going to make one other comment when you talked about Boston. You know, we had an attorney on last week, and I talked, John Monroe is an attorney that does a lot of work for Wisconsin Carry. And I asked him, I said, tell us, you know, because, and I'll be honest, I didn't know if there's exceptions in the law when there's exigent circumstances. And so it's interesting when he talked about what went on in Boston, you know, the Fourth Amendment certainly applies there. He said, you know, the difference might be if the police saw one of the terrorists run into a building. That would be an example where they probably wouldn't need a warrant to follow him into a building. But and we don't know if these people gave permission when the police came to the door. It certainly didn't appear that these people were giving permission or had been given permission for the police to come in. But it was troubling for me to see. And that's why and I truly didn't know Sheriff Clark's perspective on that as a law enforcement officer. But I'm glad to see that he felt that was troublesome as well, because I think it's troublesome.
Okay. Thank you.
Bob, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep.
So it's interesting in perspective, and I'm now going to make the jump here, and we'll get into the and certainly if any of the future callers want to make a comment about Sheriff Clark's comments, more than welcome. But I'm interested to get into the you know, drinking and carrying debate. I actually had this discussion yesterday with a fellow patriot, had a friend who joined me out on my boat, and we were having a couple drinks, carrying as we always do, and discussed the issue of drinking and carrying. And first, most importantly, is for people to consider, you know, what's legal here in Wisconsin. There's a legal side to this question. There's a practical side to this question. On the legal side, it's legal to drink and drive in Wisconsin, but it's illegal to be drunk and drive in Wisconsin. In the same way, it's legal to drink and carry in Wisconsin, but it is illegal to be intoxicated and carry. Now, with respect to drinking and driving, we have legislation and case law that really defines what is drinking and driving. We also have, with carry, we don't have legislative definitions of what intoxicated carry is. So therefore, right now it's a gray area in Wisconsin, like, what is intoxicated carry? When there is no legislative definition for example, for intoxicated carry. When there is no legislative definition, it becomes an issue of case law, and case law will establish, fill in the blank, so to speak, of where the legislation doesn't. I think it's reasonable to assume that 0.08, which is intoxicated for driving purposes, is probably the standard that they're going to use for carrying as well. But I actually have a few issues with that we'll get to later. We've got a caller on the line, and we'll take this caller right now. Good evening. You're on Well Armed Radio. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Kurt from Milwaukee.
Well, Kurt, thanks for calling in. Kurt, what are you packing tonight?
I generally carry a CZ75 9mm.
Excellent. Open carry, concealed carry?
I actually prefer open carry. There's a lot of arguments between the concealed carry and open carry, which is better. My philosophy tends to be more on the side of the open carry, for both speed, easier access. The fact that I feel that open carry can prevent a situation where concealed carry is only going to stop one once it's already started.
Yeah, the deterrent factor. Well, interesting. You've tuned into the show. We had Sheriff Clark on. We're talking about drinking and carrying. What was your comment?
Well, I've never been that much of a drinker. I've been drunk enough so few times I can count it on both hands. But there are still times I drink socially. I'm pretty much carrying all the time, and while obviously I can't carry while I'm out in any business that serves alcohol, because there it is expressly forbidden unless I go jump through a couple of hoops with the owner. That just isn't worth it. So generally when I'm drinking and carrying, it's usually with a friend. It's one or two beers. There was one incident. I've been having a stressful day. I neglected to take any breaks or lunches so I could finish a work project in a schedule. Told everyone that I was kind of having a bad day, and they kept putting drinks in front of me. After about the second one, and I realized that I hadn't eaten all day and this is going to go straight to me, I walked out to my van, opened up my safe, dropped every single thing that I was carrying in there, and then went back in and enjoyed the drink. It's a matter of responsibility. Stop before you reach a point where you have to worry about it, because while I believe it is a right for everyone to carry, every right can also come with responsibilities that need to be adhered to.
Yeah, I agree. And when it comes to drinking and carrying, we talk about what's practical and what's advisable and what's legal. Here in Wisconsin, this is different than a lot of states. Here in Wisconsin, it's legal to carry in a place that serves alcohol. It's not legal to be served alcohol while you're carrying in there, but you could, drink with your friends or be drinking at a picnic but once if you're carrying inside of an establishment that serves alcohol, you can even, it's not even an absolute sobriety situation. You can have alcohol in your system. You just can't be intoxicated, but you can't be served while you're in there. So, a lot of, I think the question that I raise or would raise hypothetically for a lot of people, and it's an interesting answer that you'll often get depending on who you speak to, but do you give up your right to self-defense because you've had a drink? And I don't believe that you do. And in fact, I think it's a pretty bad practice if it became, well, for example, even if it was law that you couldn't carry and drink, or that you couldn't carry in a place that served alcohol, because then you're pretty much guaranteeing a criminal target a place that serves alcohol, because everybody coming outside of that wouldn't be armed. The other thing that I've heard is a lot of people that just like, designated driver, if you're going to go out and drink, there's a designated carrier. And I think that's an interesting concept as well.
I'm actually a designated carrier myself.
Excellent. Well, Kurt, I appreciate you calling in. As far as Sheriff Clark's comments, I see your 414 area code. Are you Milwaukee resident, Milwaukee County?
Yes.
Have you heard his public service announcement before tonight, or was this first time?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually been following a lot of patriotic things. I maintain activity on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group. And I've helped out at a few of the organizations, too. So I definitely have a strong feeling for what you have done, what Doc Clark is doing for us, and everything that's going forward.
Excellent. Well, Kurt, thanks so much for calling in, and thanks for caring and being part of the CARI movement.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Have a good night. It's interesting to hear people's perspective when it comes to drinking and carrying, and certainly, you know, feel free to call in 646-716-8739 if you have a comment yourself. And I wasn't sure, based upon his comments, if when he mentioned where he'd been drinking, but he went after having a few more that he went and put his gun away. But that's the law in Wisconsin. You can be in a bar carrying, but you can't be served while you're carrying in that bar. Before I took that call, we had discussed that where legislation leaves a gap, it's up to case law, it's up to judges and attorneys to fight and argue case law to establish what is legal and what are the definitions. And right now, I think at some point the legislation might clarify it. We've got another caller on the line here. I'll take that in a second, so just hold the line there. 715 area code. I think it's got to be north. It's the northwest part of the state. With drinking and driving, even before the law codified that it used to be 0.01 was legal definition of intoxication, and then it was 0.08 is now legal definition of intoxication. Some states in their legislation suggest that the legal definition for intoxication, actually I shouldn't say suggest, some states' legislation defines illegal intoxication for carrying as 0.04. I think there might even be some states that are 0.02. I think there's some states that have absolute sobriety for carrying. Wisconsin is not one of them. There is no legal definition of what intoxicated is. I think it's reasonable to presume that you're probably going to see the same definition that you would for driving to this point. But I think that's an interesting angle if someone was to be cited for intoxicated carry. And I actually don't know the implications of that citation. I don't know if that would even result in loss of your concealed carry license. But it's going to be interesting to see that litigated. And it could certainly be cleared up by the legislature. They could, in future legislatures, define what intoxicated carry is. And there could be future legislatures that make Wisconsin an absolute sobriety state. We'll take a call here. Good evening. You're on Well Armed Radio. Who's this?
Yes, Nick. Bruce Thilo.
Bruce, how are you?
Real great. Get ready for work tomorrow.
So I'm looking here, Bruce, 715 area code. That's is that northwest part of the state?
That would be central Wisconsin.
Central Wisconsin.
Back in Stevens Point.
Excellent. I'm going to get my area codes mastered here in a few weeks. What was your comment? Did you heard Sheriff Clark's comments earlier? We're talking about drinking and carrying.
Yes, I certainly did hear Sheriff Clark's comments, and I stand by him 110%. I just wanted to add to your, where you're talking about with the drinking and driving. Now, see, I have a Class A CDL license. I don't know if you have a Class A or not. For you, legal intoxication is 0.08. For me, legal intoxication is 0.04. I just wanted to pass that along.
With the commercial driver's license?
Yes, and that is with a personal vehicle or a commercial license, with a commercial vehicle.
So if you hold a CDL, even when you drive your personal vehicle, the definition of intoxication is 0.04.
That is correct.
Interesting. I wasn't aware. A reason for me to never get my CDL.
Well, just don't drink and drive.
Well, Bruce, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Be well armed.
Bye-bye. You too.
It's interesting that something I didn't realize that the commercial – I think I've heard before that there's some different restrictions for people with commercial driver's licenses. But here, as we have in Wisconsin, the legislative definition not being not existing as far as what is legal intoxication for carrying, I think it'll be an interesting angle to take for an attorney. And again, given that the citation itself of intoxicated carry might not even result in the loss of your concealed carry license, I'd have to check that. I should have checked that as I researched for this topic for the show. But I think an interesting angle might be that when you're driving, you're operating that motor vehicle. 0.08 is the legal definition for that. I got to be honest, I think driving a car is a lot more complicated than carrying. I think if I was an attorney, I would try to make the case, let's say I was cited for intoxicated carry, perhaps at 0.08, 0.09, I might make the argument that a gun in a holster is more the equivalent of your car in the garage. Drinking and driving, you're operating that vehicle out on the roads in and amongst and around people. But when you're carrying, that gun in the holster is more equivalent to your car in the garage. We've got a call on the line here, 661 area code, and I do not know where 661 is, so we'll find out who's on and their comments. Good evening. You're on Well Armed Radio. Who's this?
Hi, Nick. This is John out of Pewaukee.
Hey, John. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. So, John, you've heard the show tonight. Is your comments with respect to Sheriff Clark or drinking and carrying?
Drinking and carrying, actually. What I wanted to make a point is I think the decision to consume alcohol and carry at the same time is going to be a lot of dependent upon the person's personality under the influence of alcohol. So I know some people who become very combative, they become very argumentative when they're drinking. Myself personally, I become extremely affectionate and I love everybody. So if you're the type of person who doesn't react well to alcohol, it's probably not your best judgment to consume while carrying. You just kind of have to look at how you react under the influence to, you know, when making that decision to carry and consume.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, certainly, you know, throughout life's experiences, you come to know people and have had interactions with people who really, you could pretty much count on every time they drink, they're going to get in a fight. And that's definitely,
yes, exactly.
That's definitely the kind of person who needs to, and I think, you know, in their sober moments, those people probably realize that. And it's definitely something that they'd want to consider, and certainly not drink and carry. I sometimes wonder if those kinds of individuals, if you're the type of person who gets every time you drink, you get in a fight. I wonder if you've made it to 21 years of age without a criminal record of some kind that would prevent you from getting your concealed carry license. I suppose you could have a lot of disorderly conducts that for bar fights that don't result in a felony and don't result in losing your carry privileges. But it is an interesting topic. And what with regard to, you know, drinking and carrying, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, if they're going to go out and have a drink at a restaurant or a bar, you know, right now that's illegal. If you're concealed carrying, you can't be served in a bar. You know, I think that makes people a target. I think that that if I was a criminal and I wanted to find people who were easier victims, that's probably something I would look for. I think I'd look for, you know, if I was going to rob people coming out of a restaurant, I'd choose a place that served alcohol, and with the hope that that people, obviously, as they can't have even a drink in an establishment that serves alcohol and carry, would be less likely to be armed.
Well, another thing in that scenario is, you know, once you're under the influence, your reaction time is a lot slower. So even if you are unarmed or armed, you're becoming an easier target just for the fact that you don't react as you normally would. So they're going to have upper hand on you just because they're sober.
Yeah, I think that's true. Whenever I debate people on this topic, I often make the comment that, you know, when I have a cold and I'm sick, my reactions, reflexes are extremely altered. And for me, when I'm tired, I think that has a much more substantial effect on my reaction time than drinking. I actually saw some statistics that the drunk driving crashes that resulted in death, the huge percentage of those were very late at night. Obviously, night driving in and of itself presents more challenges even for sober people, but it's interesting to note that it's often the combination of drinking and being tired that is what I believe is most deadly, and that's just a personal opinion. I'm not a researcher. I haven't researched the subject, but I think that, you know, when we talk about being altered in terms. The most dangerous I've ever been behind the wheel was not when I was drinking; it was when I was tired. And I would agree with that. Got to certainly. I mean, there have been times, and it sticks out in my head that there's been times I could not keep it on the road. I was so tired, completely sober, but I was so tired, and I thought, you know, I'm far more dangerous right now than I've been if I certainly. I mean, I know how I feel when I'm 0.08. which is legal intoxication for driving. And I think to myself, I'm far more dangerous tonight being so tired than I have been when I've been driving when I'm 0.01, but that's how our laws exist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for calling in. Are you packing as we speak?
Kel-Tec PF9.
Excellent. Well, thanks for calling in and listening to the show. Be well armed.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
Have a good night.
Bye.
The last episode I had 2 weeks ago, I ran out of time before I had the opportunity to make a couple quick free plugs for some people that have been a part of Wisconsin Carry who have Second Amendment-related businesses. So I want to give a plug right now. Tactical T-Shirts. Brian is a member of Wisconsin Carry, and he started a little T-shirt operation here, Tactical T-Shirts. I want to put in a plug for Brian. Website www.tacticalt-shirts.com. T-shirts is spelled out T-E-E shirts. Feel free to drop over. I think Brian, I don't know if Brian does the designing himself, but he has some great work with custom T-shirt design, Second Amendment themed T-shirts, some interesting and unique products there. I think he sent me a message earlier tonight that there's a discount code. So if you go to tacticalt-shirts.com, now watch me get the discount code wrong, but the tacticalt-shirts.com is the website, and the discount code is WAR10 for Well Armed Radio 10, 10% off shirts with that code. So definitely stop over to Tactical T-Shirts, pay Brian's website a visit, take a look around, you might find something you like. Moving on to our next subject. I think we've kind of hashed through drinking and carrying pretty well. I've got about 19 minutes left. Last time I had during my test episode, I ran my feed right up to the moment that I wanted to end the show and actually got cut off the last caller we had last week, Nazir, the armed citizen from Aldi's. So this week I ran a 2-hour feed through my the provider for the broadcast, and but I plan to end the show around 9 o'clock. We may run a few minutes over, but so we might not get to all the topics tonight. But the next topic I have on my list here is Senator Ron Johnson. Back during the last Senate campaign, I shouldn't say that. I should say second to last, because the last Senate campaign was Tommy Thompson and Tammy Baldwin. Previous to that, I guess it would have been 2 years prior to that, when Senator Ron Johnson was elected. I guess that would have been 2010. I know a lot of people in the Second Amendment community, a lot of people in the gun rights community, were questioning Senator Johnson's stance on right to carry. And I think it might have been justified. I believe that there was, and now I'm going to go based on hearsay, but from members that I spoke to who talked to him, I recall they said that he had said that he... I can't remember if he said he wasn't a gun owner, but that he had mentioned that he didn't necessarily see a problem with. And then I believe, I don't recall if the topic was restrictions, certain restrictions on the Second Amendment and right to carry, said it was something that he wasn't intimately familiar with. And it's been interesting to me as we've watched Ron Johnson over the past few months with regard to the wake of the Sandy Hook school shooting and the push for new gun restrictions that fell in place after that. Senator Johnson, I don't want to say surprise, but to my pleasure, participated in the filibuster to block any legislation from the Senate. And that vote, I shouldn't say participated in the filibuster, but voted, I'm going to get my syntax wrong here, but he was in support of the filibuster to block debate. Unfortunately, there was not enough senators who were willing to filibuster to block debate, so there was debate on the Manchin-Toomey. I believe that was – I don't know if that was the name of the bill. I should take it back. It was Feinstein's bill. But he voted to block, or he voted to block debate. That didn't happen. They did have debate. There were some people who were against the new legislation, but thought, let's just have the debate. Then also voted against any new regulations. And the statement that he released, I thought was just very well written, well put together. And I thought it said a lot about Ron Johnson. I don't want to say as a politician, but really as a person, knowing during the Senate campaign that he ran that the Second Amendment wasn't a strong area based upon feedback that I got from members. Not that he was per se weak in that area, but that he didn't come off as a gun owner wasn't something I think, based upon things that I heard during the campaign, that he was very cutting edge on, so to speak. His release, press release after he voted against these new restrictions, I thought was fantastic. I wanted to read some of it. The first comment he made is that he cares deeply about preventing crime, and he also cares about freedom. And I wish that more politicians would weigh those two things with the same consideration. How many politicians don't care about your freedom at all? And actually, I don't even know if they care about preventing crime, but they really care a lot about giving power to government and legislation, feeling good and doing something. So I'm going to read this, the remainder of this statement from him. The images coming from Newtown last fall were nothing less than a nightmare come true. Every American was saddened and disturbed by the actions of a seriously disturbed young man who shot his way into a school and committed mass murder. Immediately afterward, President Obama announced Vice President Biden would lead a comprehensive review of the causes of this kind of senseless violence. Most Americans support a complete conversation to determine the root causes. Unfortunately, what could have been a meaningful conversation, possibly leading to effective measures designed to better protect Americans, was quickly hijacked by the anti-gun lobby. I'm going to pause there for a minute. This is what was probably the most shameful thing I saw after Newtown, was just coming out of the woodwork. Politicians who've expressed previously their desire to just ban guns, ban your right to carry, right to own certain kinds of guns, turn around and just try to push that same legislation through because they finally had an opportunity that fit. You know, the shooter used an assault rifle. We had here in Milwaukee the Sick Temple shooting, where a gentleman passed a background check, bought a gun, and went and shot up the Sick Temple. And sadly, one of the elders at that temple went after the shooter, and I think was able to make contact with him, physical contact with him, with a butter knife. And obviously a butter knife is no match for a man with a gun. But how differently could that have turned out if that gentleman had, instead of attacking that shooter with a butter knife, been able to defend himself with a gun? But nonetheless, we had that situation, and there was no real crime. I mean, there was certainly all the antis that are just going to generalize about gun violence and try to make a pejorative picture of lawful gun ownership, try to pair those all together. But there was no hook there because this guy had passed a background check. So we didn't see a real big pushback against or push for new gun restrictions at that point, simply because the conditions didn't fit. I mean, this guy passed a background check. And then we had the Brookfield shooting. And again, that guy used a handgun, didn't use an assault rifle. And now in that case, he bought the gun online, and right away, Mayor Barrett starts going out and pushing for mandatory background checks, because they had one instance where someone bought a gun online. So when we see that now with Sandy Hook, I wonder how much different the conversation would have gone the past 6 months if the shooter at Sandy Hook had used a 12-gauge shotgun. I wonder how much different the conversation. I mean, I believe the carnage would have been similar, the same, perhaps. You know, a 12-gauge shotgun loaded with, you know, a buckshot, or again, I'm going to demonstrate my lack of ballistics knowledge, but there's loads that you can get for shotguns that would do just as much or more damage than an assault rifle would, a .223 assault rifle. But how much differently would this conversation have been over the last 6 months if he had just killed the same number of children, but used a shotgun instead? I can't help but feel like when the anti-gun lobby gets their perfect scenario, they pounce on it. And that's what happened with Sandy Hook. He used an assault rifle, and that gave him their opportunity. it's interesting when Senator Johnson talks about a meaningful conversation, but instead of that, singularly focused on gun control. I'm going to go back to his statement here. Unfortunately, what could have been a meaningful conversation, possibly leading to effective measures designed to better protect Americans, was quickly hijacked by the anti-gun lobby, and wasn't it ever. Instead of a comprehensive approach, they singularly focused on gun control and resurrected a call for the previously tried and failed banning of scary-looking pistols, rifles, shotguns, and various forms of ammunition. Democrats in the Senate eventually realized that gun-grabbing legislation was not going to pass, so they introduced a bill that would do little or nothing to reduce the violence, but would infringe the rights, increase the costs, and significantly inconvenience law-abiding citizens. Background checks are already required in most commercial gun sales. The bill from Senator Schumer would have extended them in a number of intrusive ways. For example, this bill would have made it a crime for you to give a gun to your nephew as a gift, lend a rifle to your cousin for deer season without first paying for a background check. It would have required a federal record of every firearm sale, recording who was the buyer and what was purchased. These are infringements on the rights of law-abiding gun owners, rights so crucial to our freedom that the Founding Fathers put them in the Second Amendment to the Constitution. The Manchin-Toomey Amendment was also fatally flawed. More importantly, and after all the speeches and politicizing by the anti-gun lobby, including Senator Schumer's bill, nothing in Senator Schumer's bill or in the Manchin-Toomey alternative would have prevented the tragedy in Newtown, nor prevent similar tragedies in the future. I voted no on the Senate motion to proceed to this misguided federal intrusion into our lives. It is consistent with promises I made during my campaign to oppose legislation that steps on the people's freedom, and consistent with my voting record on other legislation that would diminish our liberty as Americans. You know, I know that there was people who were concerned about how strongly Senator Johnson felt about right to carry, but I'm so impressed with what he did here in being willing to step out there and really educate himself on the topic. I mean, he said during the campaign that and again, I wish I could remember his exact words, but I don't recall it was he wasn't a gun owner or something, but he clearly took the time to educate himself on the topic, and I don't believe just towed the party line, because there was a lot of Republicans who didn't vote to block debate, who didn't want to support the filibuster, and Senator Johnson did, and there was a handful of Republicans who were willing to support background checks and intrusions into people's lives. So I just think Senator Johnson has really proved himself here to really be a strong advocate for freedom and do what intelligent people do. You know, when they're honest about their positions, and then when the time comes to deal with an issue, they educate themselves and then make the right decision. And I think that's what happened here. So kudos to Senator Johnson for that. As we see too many politicians, you know, it's another topic that I had here today, and I didn't know if I'd have time to work it in, but it was too interesting not to share. I often get requests for interviews, and I had one recently from a student at I'm going to get the Tulsa High School wrong, but it was either Wauwatosa East. So his instructor contacted me and said, "Hey, I have a student who's going to do a story on the gun issue." I thought, sure. So I gave him my contact information and was looking forward to it. I thought maybe here's a chance to really get a good, solid pro-gun message into the schools, even in a tiny, tiny way, and in this one class with this one project that this student was working on. My optimism was quickly reduced when I got the questions from this student who was doing this project. But I got enough of a kick out of them that I thought I'd share them with you here today. So the first question was, should specialized rounds such as hollow point rounds or incendiary rounds be available to the public only for the military and law enforcement, or should you have to have a permit to be able to buy such rounds? And I saw that question, and I thought, I was disappointed that I knew exactly where the rest of these questions were going to go, and quickly realized that any hope that this was going to be a thoughtful delve into the gun topic for this student probably wasn't going to happen. So I sent him originally initially we were going to get together for an interview in person, and I was going to go to the school. I don't know how that fell apart. I think he said he had to ask permission to have a visitor at the high school from the principal or something. And shortly thereafter, that I cracked a joke to him when we were scheduling this, that I usually don't go places where I can't be armed, but that I'd make an exception in this situation. And shortly after that, he thought he had emailed me and said, well, maybe we can just do this interview by email. So that's what ended up happening here. His next question: should certain attachments such as foregrips and high-powered scopes be available to the public? So I thought that was an interesting question again. Now I know exactly where the student's going with this. And we talk about field position in sports, and really field position with the gun debate is certainly an appropriate context. The field position battle here with this student, you know, we're talking about the gun debate, and immediately the questions are all on these restrictions for law-abiding students, law-abiding citizens from this student, instead of a more expansive view, talking about mental health issues, talking about dealing with crime and empowering people or arming teachers. So unfortunately, I was clear here, the field position debate had already been lost. Next question: should there be a size limit on magazines/clips? Next question: should any person with a history of mental illness be able to purchase a firearm? Got into a little bit more of a discussion with him on that one. Next question: should a more extensive background check be made effective to reduce the number of dangerous people having access to firearms? That whole question in and of itself just contradicts itself. Last question: should any person with any kind of felony charge be able to purchase a firearm, comma, no just people convicted of domestic violence? I don't know if I could make sense of the grammar in that sentence, but that was my, I thought I'd share that. That was my recent, most recent interview request from a student. And I'm not making a greater criticism of the public school system, probably more just making an observation, perhaps generalizing about the context of debate on this whole topic, certainly in schools. 8:56, I'm going to run till about 9 o'clock here. Had one other Second Amendment-friendly business I wanted to tell you about. It's 30 Below Leather, summer season coming up upon us. 30 Below Leather is located in Wisconsin Dells, member of the Right to Carry community here in Wisconsin, is the owner of 30 Below Leather. So I told him that we would put a plug in for his store. It's let me get the address for you here. 30 Below Leather, Wisconsin Dells. And, of course, now my computer's freezing and I'm not getting the web address. But 30 Below Leather, Wisconsin Dells, owner is a strong supporter of Second Amendment right to carry. I'm going to play with my fingers here and try and Google and talk at the same time. I think this is what they call Phil in the radio world. Here it is. Below Leather is 513 Broadway, Wisconsin Dells, 608-253-0441. So if you're in the Wisconsin Dells area this spring and summer, enjoying your family vacation time off, definitely make a point to stop in 30 Below Leather. Looks like there's other 30 Below Leather stores as well, so I'm not sure if this is a franchise, but the local store there in Wisconsin Dells is owned by a Wisconsin Carry member, member of the Facebook page. Stop in, definitely tell them that you heard about the show on Well Armed Radio. Over the next few months, hopefully we'll have some more some sponsors for the program and give us some opportunity to do some more things. But 30 Below Leather, Wisconsin Dells, everything's below $30. Large selection of leather products, purses, wallets, belts. Looks like a great selection of things. 608-253-0441, 513 Broadway, Wisconsin Dells. So I got those in. I missed those guys last week during the test broadcast for Well-Armed Radio. So we're coming up at 9 o'clock here. I want to thank you for tuning in tonight. Thanks for bearing with me as we work through learning myself here, learning to multitask with my studio. We're going to, next broadcast will be 2 weeks from today, I'm going to eventually probably work to a weekly format every Sunday night. 8 o'clock is a normal time. Next show will be at 8 o'clock, 2 weeks from tonight. And then I believe next week is next weekend. What's next weekend? At Preakness. I'm a horse racing fan. The family and I like to pick our horses Friday nights, sit down with the family and the computer and go through the horse listing, and everybody gets to pick a horse, gives a kids find it fun. It's kind of like that's going to be a sexist joke about women watching sports because they like the color of the jerseys and picking their favorite team on the color of the jerseys. But kids do the same thing with the horses. Unfortunately, a couple years ago, I shared with them the odds. And once they realize that there's odds on these horses and they can figure out which horses are supposed to be good and not, then the kids do a lot better picking their horses than they used to. So just a little side note there, a little off topic, as I hope to do from time to time here on the radio. But definitely try it out with the kids. Preakness is next Saturday evening. And if you're looking for something to do Friday night, sit down with the family, pick out your horses, and tune in Saturday for the races. I think Kentucky Derby was a few weeks ago. Orb, I think, won last year. I had picked I'll Have Another, I think, was the winning horse for the Derby. I picked that horse. And then, of course, our family rule is if you win with your horse, you get to keep your horse for the next race. And then I'll Have Another won the Preakness, went for the Triple Crown at the Belmont Stakes, and then I think had to scratch with a leg injury. So that was disappointing. Didn't get to see a Triple Crown last year. So that's the end of the show today. Thanks for tuning in. Hope to talk to you again in 2 weeks. And with that, have a good night. And be well armed.